economic warfare, political spin, clandestine operations, unredacted, with Rachel Marsden, lifting the black ink to reveal the covert information and intelligence around global events. And now, here is your host, Rachel Marsden.
Hey there, you're listening to Rachel Marsden. I'm with you for the next hour here on Unredacted, as usual. Great show for you today. In the first part of the show, we're going to be talking with a bomb disposal expert who served in the UK military, has an amazing history in the British Armed Services. We're going to talk to Major Chris Hunter about what's on his mind with respect to everything that's going on in the world right now, and wow, are things ever heating up. In the second part of the show, we're going to cover more of the same territory, this time from the perspective of a retired lieutenant commander and reconnaissance marine naval intelligence officer, James Sisko. He's been on the show before, but he's going to join us again to talk about what's on his mind specifically with regards to diplomacy and how diplomacy might actually serve to help us get out of some of the situations that we're in right now around the world. And when I say we, I talk as somebody who lives and is from the Western Hemisphere, as opposed to the Eastern Hemisphere, which seems to be having a lot more success than we are these days fighting the Islamic State. Although it's interesting, and I'm very gradually getting out of the topic of this week's analysis as published in the Tribune papers. You can go and read it if you want to jump the gun. You can't possibly wait. You can check it out over on the website at unredactedshow.com. But Pascal Boniface, who's in charge of a think tank here in Paris, he's made a very interesting argument. And he's basically saying that terrorism isn't as big of a deal as everyone's making it out to be, which is an interesting perspective when you're based in Paris, where there was a terror attack that killed over 128 people and injured hundreds of others on November 13th of last year. Not to mention the Charlie Hebdo attacks on a satirical magazine, which took place about a year ago, just over a year ago, here in Paris. That's kind of an interesting perspective for somebody in France to hold. And I suppose what he's arguing is not that terrorism isn't a problem, but that there's too much emphasis on it. Perhaps that's the case elsewhere. For example, in the United States, we often hear about terror suspects who are rounded up, arrested, charged. And it just so happens to be that these are individuals who had interaction with FBI informants or people who were otherwise either employed or directed by the FBI, which leads people to suspect that maybe if they were left to their own devices, they wouldn't have had the brains or the resources to be able to pull off any kind of terrorist act. So it's a kind of a valid question. But terrorism is a problem. Are we giving too much attention to it? I don't know, but if you were watching the debates over the weekend for the candidates, the Republican Party squaring off in South Carolina this week, they had a debate. Seems like there's a debate before every single primary, so this is likely to go on forever because the primaries aren't going to end until sometime in June, I believe. Hopefully the debates will stop before then, because I'm not sure if there's any ground that they haven't covered so far. But anyway, in that debate, it was largely dominated by foreign affairs, just like the last debate prior to the New Hampshire primary was also heavily dominated by foreign affairs, which is kind of an interesting development, given that the concerns of Americans and Europeans are largely domestic. Economic issues, social issues, education. Everybody's very concerned about everything that's going on right at home. Yet, we cannot escape this debate about foreign affairs. Why? because we are so interconnected these days that something that happens overseas, whether it's a market opening up as a result of a regime falling and or a marketing opening up like Iran most recently as a result of sanctions being dropped or walls going up, for example, in the case of Russia as a result of Western sanctions against Russia, all of these things impact local companies. Local companies meaning companies in America, companies in Europe, jobs in those companies, revenues in those companies, which ultimately all trickles down to hit you in the pocketbook. That's why it's important. So to say that, hey, I'm here at home and there are all sorts of domestic issues that I'm concerned about, but I already care about foreign affairs, which is something you often hear, less and less so these days. And rightfully so. But it's something you still hear from time to time. Well, at least the candidates realize that you really can't deny the impact of everything else in the world that's connected to your pocketbook. And your pocketbook is connected to China. It is connected to Syria and the events in the Middle East. It is connected to terrorism. And the title of this week's analysis for the Tribune papers that I wrote is Candidates Are Peddling a Laughable Syria Narrative. Now, this is kind of troubling. You'll have to bear with me on this because I'll explain why. Have you ever asked yourself the question, what if Russia and the Syrian government succeed in wiping out the Islamic State? And by that, I mean those who are still in the Middle East who haven't exploited the refugee flood into Europe to escape the Middle East and to embed themselves in Europe and elsewhere. But what if Russia and Syria end up wiping out ISIS in the Middle East? And it's a valid question and a distinct possibility because the Syrian army is closing in on Raqqa right now, which is a stronghold of that terror group, so-called caliphate in the Middle East. And if this was to occur, a very critical narrative that we've been hearing among establishment candidates in both parties, Democrat and Republican, will die. Now, what is that narrative? Well, it's interesting what Hillary Clinton said during her debate, last one. She said that Russia has not gone after ISIS or any other terrorist groups. Oh, is that right? Well, based on my observation and those of many others, that's all they've been doing in the Middle East. You know, you, Hillary, destabilized the region as Secretary of State of the United States of America, and Russia has been trying to clean up this mess ever since. And I'm saying that as a pro-Westerner, as somebody who's from the West, who's proud of being from the West, cannot for the life of me figure out why there's a perpetual denial of reality around all this. We've already seen how Hillary has had a penchant for misplaced focus and how it can lead to disastrous consequences on the terrorism front. I mean, she was Secretary of State when the Syrian rebels morphed into ISIS right under her nose, and also when a group of Western-backed rebels deposed Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. Remember that? 2011? Yeah, she was Secretary of State during that too. Now, even at that time, there was all this rhetoric about the Libyan rebels were going to take out Gaddafi, the bad guy, right? Well, who were the Libyan rebels? Just like who are the Syrian rebels? Let's dig a little deeper into that. At the time, back in 2011, 2010, there were whispers already from the onset here in France among the French intelligence community that the Libyan rebels were jihadists who might end up being worse than the deposed regime of Gaddafi if they ever had the chance to fill that power vacuum. And in fact, there's a gentleman named Fazi Boukatef, who's a leader of the anti-Gaddafi rebels during the first battle of Benghazi in February 2011. And he admitted in an interview that I heard and saw on French television that there were indeed jihadists fighting alongside the rebels. And then he kind of qualified that by saying that they were Libyans first and foremost who fought under a single flag for a united cause, blah, blah, blah. But still, you have to ask, when candidates on both sides of the aisle object to Russia's bombing of rebel groups in Syria known to be full of jihadists, you have to wonder if they're demonstrating their own ignorance or if they're just doing others' bidding. Jeb Bush, another establishment candidate on the Republican side this time, said in the debate over the weekend, Russia is not taking out ISIS. They're attacking our team. So now the Syrian rebel terrorists are our team? Right. They're attacking our team, the team that we've trained and the team that we've been supporting. And he's really concerned about the Syrian rebels, of which only four or five actually remain, despite a $500 million program. $500 million, and there are four or five that aren't full-fledged, either disappeared or turned terrorists. And I'm not making this up. This is actually according to testimony to the Senate Armed Services Committee last September by General Lloyd Austin, who's the head of U.S. Central Command. And Bush continued, Jeb Bush. He said, Russia is not even attempting to take out ISIS. They're attacking the troops that we're supporting. We need to create a coalition, a Sunni-led coalition on the ground with our special operators to destroy ISIS and bring about stability. And you can't do that with Assad in power. Oh, right. So now it's only the Sunnis who can fix things and Saudis. When the Saudis and the Qataris and the Sunnis were the ones who armed and supported ISIS while they were Syrian rebels to become ISIS. And nobody really likes Iran in the region, right? The whole idea is you've got to have a Sunni coalition so that Iran disappears. Yeah, well, problem with that is that there's an argument implied here that Iran is deliberately just moving into the region of their own volition, taking over, taking charge, and that they're doing this kind of in a belligerent way. That's the implication. When the reality is quite simply that Iran is part of this Russian coalition, Russian-led coalition, to dispose of ISIS. And Vladimir Putin has actually outright said that it's thanks to Iranian intelligence that they're able to advance in their initiative so far. So what's really interesting here is that all of these suggestions from these establishment candidates, and specifically I'm talking about Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, if they were to actually carry out their statements to their logical conclusion, their advice would actually result in a full-on proxy war in the Middle East with Russia, Syria, and Iran on one side, and the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and their allies on the other. And when Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev was asked about the possibility of Saudi ground troops in Syria, he told a German newspaper, and this is a direct quote, he said, the Americans and our Arab partners must consider whether or not they want a permanent war. And some people took that quote as meaning, hey, we're heading towards World War III, which isn't exactly a foreign concept if you've been listening to this show. In fact, well over a year ago, I wrote about that very same Tribune client papers that this analysis appears in. In fact, the title of that analysis was, Has World War III Already Begun? Well, now it's being evoked by other commentators who are thinking if we end up with being bogged down in the Middle East with ground troops, with Arab ground troops backed by the United States and Saudi Arabia, and then Iranians and Russians and Syrians on the other side, all in the name of fighting ISIS, which, I mean, it could just turn into a complete disaster. So that's the question that needs to be put to American voters. Do they want a permanent war in the Middle East? This is where we're heading with this. And, why all the concern about the Iran, Russia, Syria axis when they're the ones closest to reclaiming Raqqa and defeating the Islamic State? It's interesting that the candidates supported by the deep-pocketed establishment are all singing from the same hymn book, regardless of party affiliation. Further evidence that this election should be about the purge of special interest bribery, concern that transcends left-right ideology. And that's what's really interesting about this election to me. I cannot remember the last time the two frontrunners on either side of the political divide were anti-establishment candidates. When we think back to anti-establishment candidates in the past, and they've always been traditionally either third-party candidates who nobody really thought had much of a chance, or in fact, it wasn't even a matter of thinking they didn't. You knew they didn't have any chance against the two big parties. Or they were people who ran in the primaries in either party, but they were very quickly eliminated early on in the race because they just didn't have the money. They didn't have the support. They didn't have, their message wasn't audible, as we like to say in communications field. They were not audible. What has changed? Well, this is another whole analysis, but because my next guest has yet to call in, I'm not sure what happened. I guess it's late in the UK, so perhaps there is a, he was otherwise occupied. I have no idea, but I'm just going to keep going with this train of thought because it's a really interesting one. What has changed? Why are anti-establishment candidates now audible in this particular race? Why are only anti-establishment candidates audible? And I'm specifically talking Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. They're the front runners right now. And they are absolutely killing the establishment candidates. So I would argue that what changed is Donald Trump. He changed the tone of the whole conversation. At first, people thought he would be buried because when he came out guns blazing in the summer and announced his candidacy, and he had already toyed with the idea of running for president. This isn't the first time. He ultimately did in the last election and ultimately ended up backing Romney. I guess he just wasn't ready to pull the trigger at that point, but for whatever reason, or maybe the climate wasn't right. And that's the other thing, is sometimes it's a matter of being the right man for the right climate, the right time. And I think the stars in this case are perfectly aligned. So he came out of the gates, guns blazing, and he said every single politically incorrect thing that defied gravity. And everyone just kind of thought, oh, this guy's not going to last. The media, the establishment, everyone thought this guy's going to be buried because he's not saying the right things. He's not striking the right chords. He's not talking like a politician. Well, lo and behold, what happened? He doubled down. Everything he said, he doubled down. So he'd say something. Everybody would freak out. And then he'd explain himself. It created this window for him. The media was, it was like suddenly he yelled fire and everyone stopped and stared and waited to see what was going to happen. And then it gave him the luxury of having all the media focused on him while he explained his position. And he has just simply gotten better and better at explaining his positions as time has gone by. And it's something that I predicted when he first got into the race. I thought if he can match this rhetoric and hold his ground with actual policy positions that are elaborated and well thought out, he has a perfect marketing machine. And that is exactly what has happened and why he's a front runner by a long shot right now, at least according to pretty much every poll. And then what happened? Well, suddenly the establishment candidate, Hillary Clinton, who everyone thought would be a shoo-in, didn't look so appealing against somebody who was not an establishment candidate. So it really did start with Donald Trump. There was this buildup, this momentum, honesty towards a complete political incorrectness, towards shunning talking points, shunning the establishment, refusing donations from high dollar donors who normally grab a candidate's ear by shoving a few bucks in their pocket. That's kind of how it works. In fact, that's exactly how it works. And so the Democrats, because the tone had changed, Democrats started finding an appeal in that as well. So now we're dealing with two front runners who are anti-establishment candidates. And it is going to be a fascinating race if Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump end up being the two last men standing heading in to the general election in the fall. Because ultimately, regardless, think about this. This is actually amazing if you think about it. Regardless of the fact that they are day and night different in their ideological positions with respect to, you know, Bernie Sanders is a democratic socialist and Donald Trump is a hardcore pure capitalist, not a corporatist, a capitalist entrepreneur. So there's just an insane amount of daylight between their two ideological positions. However, they are in lockstep on one thing, and that is the corruption of special interests in politics. So it's going to be interesting to watch. And right now, I have my first guest on the line. So I'm going to just go straight to him. Major Chris Hunter joined the British Army in 1989 as a 16-year-old Army apprentice. He trained initially as a Russian linguist, working in defense intelligence, and after 4 years of enlisted service was selected to undergo officer training at the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. He was then commissioned into the Royal Logistic Corps, the route that will eventually lead to becoming an ammunition technology officer, British Army's bomb disposal operators. He served as a troop commander on operations in the Balkans, East Africa, and Northern Ireland, and undertook Arctic warfare training in Norway before becoming an explosive ordnance disposal operator. As an operator, he deployed on two high-threat tours in Northern Ireland and one in Iraq, undertook explosive ordnance disposal protection duties for the royal family, and assisted in the planning and conduct of numerous police operations involving the threat of explosive devices. He was also the designated technical operations officer for the National Contingency Response to the Terrorist Use of a Weapon of Mass Destruction in the UK. Later involved with a number of UK Special Forces counterterrorism units and saw active service in Afghanistan, Colombia, and Iraq, as well as on counterterrorism operations in the UK. Welcome to the show, Chris. It's good to have you.
Thank you very much. And thanks for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. So the first thing I want to ask you is, having worked in counterterrorism, having worked with all sorts of threats and risks, and having worked in the Middle East, what strikes you right now about the situation unfolding in the Middle East as it stands right now?
I think there are sort of two core areas, really. There's the Middle East itself and how that's unfolding from the sort of traditional monarchies that ruled the Middle East, both during and after the empires that we saw up until the 1700s. But also what we're seeing is a sort of divergence of the actual Islamic faith of Islam, the Sunnis and the Shias. And we're seeing this sort of battle, if you like, between Sunnis and Shias. But we're also seeing this sort of, you know, identity that's taking place in a number of different ways across the Middle East. So you're getting the Arab Springs, where, you know, there's effectively dissent, rioting, and the breakup of countries that have been stable, albeit under dictatorships. And then you're also getting those countries which seem to be, on the face of it, stable, but actually there's a serious amount of dissent taking place internally amongst those groups. And then, of course, you've got the global situation. You've got the Chinese, interests, if you like, strategically. You've got the Russian interests strategically, Iran, North Korea, and then, of course, the United States and the West, who've traditionally been the sort of, the status quo in the last 20 years. And the whole world really seems to be in a bit of disarray.
Yeah, no, there's no question about that. And having worked in Northern Ireland and understanding ideology of terrorism and motivations of people who commit these acts, is there anything that you glean from your experience in that theater that could be applied to today's situation, or is today's situation just completely off the charts in terms of anything that we've seen before?
I think the answer is yes to both of those questions. I mean, effectively, if you look at traditional counterterrorism methodology and you look at counterinsurgency methodology and you look at the whole idea that, you need to effectively have a support base to be an effective insurgency, a group of dissent, a terrorist group, whatever it might be. So the very first rule is that if you can split the support base from the insurgent group, then you can start to succeed. But what we've seen around the world, ever since man has been able to actually fight, and, one adversary may have more power, more combat power than the other, this idea of asymmetric warfare or guerrilla warfare, where they know they can't beat an adversary with conventional weaponry and arms and ammunition tactics, so they have to revert to guerrilla tactics. And what we've seen as that's evolved over hundreds of years is that it tends to fall into three core categories. It's either going to be religious, it's going to be nationalistic, or it's going to be political. But in all three areas, whatever those strategic objectives may be, whether it may be to establish a religious caliphate, as is the case with ISIS or Daesh, as they're known, or whether it may be something like the Northern Ireland campaign that the British were involved in for 30 years, where it's very much nationalistic, even though it was sort of sectarian religious divide. It was all about a united Ireland from the IRA's perspective and maintaining a united kingdom from the British perspective. So if you look at those sort of objectives, what's the one thing they all have in common? And it's the use of a tactic that will terrorize a population exponentially, more than any other tactic, more than politics, and that's terrorism. And you can use any number of different methods, but if you can terrorize a huge number of people, then you can succeed in achieving those objectives. And that's what we've seen, changing, the actual methodology and the tactics.
Yeah, two things strike me about that. The first is, Northern Ireland was relatively contained, right? They weren't heading over to other parts of, far-flung countries and pulling the same kind of attacks to the extent that we're seeing with the individuals who are involved with the Islamic State. So there's that difference that strikes me. And the other thing, too, is with respect to them all being unified under a kind of a single common cause or flag, we saw that in Libya. We've seen that now in Syria, and there definitely seems to be similarities there. But then they just can't hold it together. Like, as soon as they get any one particular group, as soon as there's a power vacuum left by a strong man or whoever happened to be running the country previously who was deposed by these terrorists or rebels, whatever you want to call them, then they, like you say, there's a second phase here where they all just start fighting among each other because that's all they've ever done anyway. And it was only the guy who was with the iron, fist who kept them from doing that for so long. So then they all
fight among each other
over power. And that didn't exist with the IRA, right?
No, that's right. I mean, they were a lot more organized. I mean, I was there as a bomb technician and as a young, a young platoon commander. And I remember when the IRA would put a bomb out, they would give a coded warning. And, it might be that they would basically give you an indication that it was a real bomb. And usually there would be 45 minutes, an hour, whatever it might be, so that the civilian population could be evacuated. And they just wanted to destroy, the infrastructure, if you like. They had political strategic objectives. Whereas with the jihadist groups, the radical Islamic groups, they definitely have a real sort of penchant for suicide attacks. And, they're very barbaric, deadly. They have no respect for life. But even within Al-Qaeda, that the United States saw a series of the most gruesome terrorist attacks ever recorded in history, and that sort of culminated on 9/11. But right. The difference between Al-Qaeda, that we thought were the worst people terror group in the world, and then ISIL, they've taken it to another level, and there's lots of similarities with them. Their nihilistic worldview, their loathing for modernity and for the West itself, the perverted interpretation of Islam. But the one thing they share is, the use of very barbaric tactics. But ISIL believe they're actually enforcing a prophecy from the Quran, which is why so many groups support them now, because they seem to be achieving that prophecy. But also the use of barbaric tactics, which went back right to the beginning of the Quran and the beginning of Islam, is something that was supposed to stave off and scare enemies and encourage people to join them. And that seems to be happening as well with their propaganda machine, their media operations machine. So it's also a lot more sophisticated than we've ever seen in history as well.
Yeah, and it also kind of ties into the times, I guess, in the sense that there are people in our Western economies who are desperate to be seen, to identify, to find a place where they belong, to find work. And I don't know how this caliphate is paying these individuals, or if they're even paying them. And that's another whole question, is if they are abandoning the West to go and work in the caliphate. And even today in the Figaro newspaper here in Paris, there's an article about how there's at least a few doctors and engineers who have left Europe to go over there, and Tunisia to go there and to serve in the Islamic State's community. But it begs the question, how are they being compensated? Is it just, here's a group of people that you belong with, and is that just enough? Is it recognition? Is it ego? Is it a sense that they belong to something? Or is it money? And if it is, they're paying them money, then I don't know if that's the case, but it begs the question, where are they getting it from?
You make a very, very good point there. And I think to motivate any sort of fighting force, whether they're terrorists or whether they're, conventional forces fighting for the greater good, there are always a number of incentives. It might be ideological. If you think about 9/11, the amount of United States citizens that signed up to go and join the armed forces that probably would never have considered it. But it was a huge amount because, they were basically inspired by those terrible events and wanted, they became far more patriotic. But you still do need to, of course, pay soldiers, usually in some form, and you need to feed them and you need to feed their families and provide for them. And what we've seen with ISIS is that, when we went into Iraq in 2003, the Saddam Hussein ran the Ba'ath Party, headed up the Ba'ath Party, and they were Sunni Muslims. And when we went in there, it was decided to, arrest, capture, remove all of those Sunnis from positions of power for obvious reasons. We didn't want them to, form a resurgence. And the majority, which was the oppressed majority, the Shias, were then put into those positions. But, of course, they weren't professional people. So what we saw was an entire leadership barrier removed. What we then saw was ISIL being formed from that Sunni leadership barrier that worked under Saddam Hussein. And al-Baghdadi himself, was an officer under Saddam Hussein. And these guys were trained in tactics. They'd fought in numerous different wars against Iran and internal insurgencies. Mm-hmm. And so they knew about tactics, they knew about strategy, and they knew how to run a country. So as they've been expanding, they've been capturing banks. They've got gold bullion. They've got money. They've captured oil fields and oil reserves. They sell the oil on the black market. And ironically, reportedly, they sell it to some of the countries that are fighting against them, And there's all sorts of infrastructure, all sorts of wealth that they've got that they continue to use to support and fund their operations. And as they expand, they just capture more of that,
Well, it's interesting to consider who these buyers of the oil are, because, we're hearing that they're selling oil to countries like Turkey or whatever. And then that begs the question, is Turkey actually on their side, or are they just playing a charade? And we've seen very recently now that Turkey is starting to show its true colors a little bit more, and they're now getting into disputes with Russia. They're now attacking the Kurds that the Russians are trying to help, who are essentially allies of the United States and the only ones who, for the longest time, were doing anything on the ground against the Islamic State. So, you know, Turkey shot down that Russian plane, and I was at Vladimir Putin's press conference just before Christmas in which he said we don't consider Turkey hostile. But now I think they may be starting to see things a little bit differently. I mean, there hasn't been any official announcement around that or a declaration. But if Turkey's been buying oil and supporting the logistics chain to get oil from ISIS territory to Turkey.
Against the very people they're fighting against, absolutely. Yeah.
Correct. Then it makes you wonder, has Turkey ever really been fighting against ISIS, or is this just some token charade? And then if Turkey's been doing that, and we certainly know that the United States wasn't really putting in a good effort until Russia got involved, and now suddenly they just sit back and complain about Russia, it makes you wonder what is really going on here under all of this. And I'm somebody who, you know, I supported George Bush during Operation Iraqi Freedom, and I thought that was the right thing to do from a humanitarian perspective. But now in retrospect, it's like that was the first domino to fall. And we've had all of these scenarios repeat themselves over and over and over in various Middle Eastern and African countries with the same ultimately poor result, because the vacuum that's created by deposing strongmen is never filled in a stable way. And so it just kind of rolls from one catastrophe to the next. And we've been watching this for 13 years now.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, there's always a degree of my enemy's enemy is my friend. Mm-hmm. But there's also always a degree of, you know, memories run deep. And one of the things that we have to remember and understand is that Turkey has been fighting against Kurdish dissidents for decades now.
Right.
And then suddenly, you know, when they're fighting, I think it's been seen as an opportunity. And if you look at some of the sort of sides, you know, it's constantly we're supporting one organization who are, you know, fighting our enemy, but they're also supporting our other enemy who are fighting another enemy. And it's so confusing, you know, Russia, who they're supporting and who they're fighting against, Iran, who they're supporting, who they're fighting against, Saudi Arabia, especially, you know. And I think the other point is people have accused Saudi especially of funding all sorts of terror groups and insurgencies around the world because of the Wahhabism and the fact that they need to sort of almost appease some of the extremist tribes and sects of the religion within Saudi Arabia to maintain that monarchy that they've got. And when you look at all the complexities of those and you look at the political situation around the world, Syria is basically the epicenter of it all. Everybody has an agenda. And, you know, Russia effectively want to be a global superpower again, but they need seaports and they need to be able to transport their energy pipelines. And Syria is the epicenter of that. China wants to do the same, but it also wants to destabilize the American petrodollar system. The United States and the West need the petrodollar system, which is effectively where Nixon, you know, realized that after the Vietnam War, the American economy was going to die. So rather than using dollars and the gold had depleted in the country, they said, right, we'll use the dollar as the currency for oil around the world. And unfortunately, a few countries then have opposed that. And Iran, Russia, and China are doing exactly that right now with Syria too. So there's a whole number of sort of factors that are quite complicated that actually directly affect our way of life. And not just in the United States, you know, across the globe. And, you know, you have to go into that real sort of deep geopolitics to understand that.
Right.
And then appreciate that everybody has an agenda in Syria, and Syria is the epicenter of ISIL, of the United States, of Russia, of China, of Iran, and, of course, you know, the European Union, and, of course, the other Middle Eastern countries as well, half of which want to support Russia and China and Assad, and the other half, of course, want to continue making money and, you know, transporting their energy reserves to the West. So
there's
a whole load of agendas too.
Right, and following on what you were saying about the currency and how important that is, as soon as Iran was able to release its oil back onto the international market, what did it do? It decided that it wanted to be paid in euros, not American dollars, but euros.
Absolutely,
significant.
And it's part of the strategy,
Right. I mean, it just makes you wonder what is going on here. And also the French government, despite the fact that the United States was a signatory to that treaty to lift sanctions against Iran and to allow for trade to normalize and reestablish itself. At the same time, France has signed all sorts of contracts. Italy has signed billions of dollars worth of contracts with Iran already. And the United States is dragging its feet getting in there. Or at least that's the impression. We don't hear about all these deals that the United States has signed with Iran at this point. So, you know, there is that ideology that's at play on the American side, not wanting to rush into something or to give the impression that they are, despite having signed a deal anyway, which everybody kind of knows. Or is that the Iranians now saying, well, great, thanks a lot, guys, but this is our preference. Now we're choosing to do business with the Europeans. I mean, I don't know what we're seeing here. Is there any guess that you might have?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happening is that actually, you know, if you look at the United States, and I was having a conversation with, you know, some of my American friends, and they were talking about Donald Trump and, you know, the British view of Donald Trump. Sometimes a few people laugh at him and can't believe some of the things he comes out with, you know. I've got some very educated American friends who say, well, why are the Brits so against him? And whether you like him or loathe him, the point is the United States now is the single global superpower. And you don't just have a president of the United States. You actually have a president of the free world. And with that comes a tremendous responsibility. It does, whether you like it or not.
Right.
And America has shouldered the burden of that responsibility for such a long time. Mm-hmm. And now what you've got is people, you know, they're negotiating with Iran because they have to, you know, something's got to be done. But the key is negotiation there. They're making concessions, but actually it's not an agreement. It's not a treaty. And everyone's got their own agenda. And unfortunately, you know, the United States is being the fair broker. And the other countries, I don't think, necessarily can be trusted to, you know, to the full extent.
Yeah, that's, I've heard a lot of that as well. And there's a lot of dealing that was going on even before the sanctions were lifted. And I know that there are French companies that were at, there are American companies, in all fairness, though, that were given Treasury Department exemptions to be able to actually operate in Iran despite the sanctions. And there are hundreds of them. So then what happened is that the French went, wait a second. So you guys are telling us that we have to abide by sanctions or else face prosecution on Wall Street through your U.S. Treasury Department for violating them. And of course, OFAC and Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, there are all sorts of prosecutions of French companies, French multinationals, for violating those sanctions in Iran at the time. And so the French are saying, wait a second, you're blaming us, charging us, prosecuting us, fining us billions of dollars, and at the same time you're operating in Iran already because you get special permission from your department. So then the French got wise and they said, okay, well, if you're a company in France, you're going, all right, well, how can we run our business through an American company as a partner into Iran? And that's what was going on in the automotive industry and other industries.
When I was a serving soldier in Iraq, you know, the coalition, the U.S.-led coalition, we were losing significant lives to Iranian-made improvised explosive devices, bombs, IEDs, roadside bombs. And, you know, there were sanctions against Iran. They couldn't get into Iran from the West the components that they needed, but they would go into Dubai, into the Emirates, and then they could be shipped legitimately from Dubai into Iran. So, you know, there were loopholes as well. And wherever there's any sort of sanction, it's like people that evade tax, isn't it? You know, they just speak to a decent accountant and find a loophole. It's exactly the same with international sanctions. And that's why, you know, we have to use, you know, the political process, diplomacy, sanctions as well, and, of course, some form of physical presence either on the ground or at least a threat of it, you know, some sort of deterrence measure.
Right. Fascinating. Thank you so much, Major Chris Hunter. It's been great to have you on the program. We'd love to have you back on again.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. All right. So we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with James Sisko. All right, so we're back now. We have James Sisko with us. He's a retired Lieutenant Commander, Reconnaissance Marine, and Naval Intelligence Officer with the U.S. Navy, and the founder and president of Enodo Global. His career plan spans from leading Marine reconnaissance missions in Operation Desert Storm to supporting the U.S. Director of National Intelligence as an authority on Afghanistan. Career highlights included leading training missions in Africa while assigned to the U.S. Embassy in Ethiopia and co-authoring Navy Counterterrorism Optimization Report while assigned to the Navy's Premier Strategic Studies Group, Deep Blue. As a result, he was hand-selected to establish the U.S. Navy's Irregular Warfare Office. He also co-authored Left of Bang with Lieutenant General Flynn of the U.S. Army and Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He's recognized within the intelligence community as a leader in sociocultural analysis. In 2001, he led strike operations for U.S. Navy carrier Air Wing One, and in 2005, he served as U.S. military liaison to Afghan President Hamid Karzai, returned to Afghanistan in 2009, and was assigned to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO's International Security Assistance Force reintegration cell, where he led reintegration activities throughout the country. And these experiences resulted in assignment to the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, where he maintains and managed Afghan intelligence and integration programs for the National Security Council. It's great to have you back on the show, James.
Hey, thanks, Rachel. I'm happy to be back.
Thanks. So I know that you've been traveling recently in the Middle East, and you've been examining the issue specifically of diplomacy and how that might be able to assist us in some of the challenges that we're facing right now. What can you tell us about that, and what comes to mind?
Well, what I'd like to do is frame the problem that we face for contemporary diplomacy, which, in my opinion, is basically a failure. The reason why we, diplomacy in the past has had some very wonderful outputs, but the current diplomatic efforts fail to achieve any tangible measures or gains, and it's because of the way that diplomacy is currently being conducted. And I was able to get some very unique insights on my recent trip to the Gulf states, Bahrain, Qatar, UAE, when I was in Abu Dhabi, and in different places, and really gaining some insights from people on the ground there in the problems they face in Yemen and Bahrain and Syria. So I'd like to, if you don't mind, indulge and speak about some of those.
Yeah, so you're talking about people on the ground who are members of governments or military services or just average people on the ground, citizens of the country.
Actually, we try to gather atmospheres from a wide range of individuals. So I spoke with individuals in the military, political representatives, and also common folks on the ground, and also individuals in different areas in the business sector.
Okay, and what is their specific interest in diplomacy, and what are they saying they'd like to see, and what is their main concern?
What we've seen, and what a theme that resonated and came up many times, was the sectarian issues, the religious divisions that currently plague the region. And a lot of what I heard time and time again, and it was from individuals across all different sects and different religions and different positions in government or in the military, was that the regional sectarian issue is a relatively new phenomenon, and that seven years ago, that you didn't have this religious strife at the magnitude that you have today, and that this is really one of the factors that underpins a lot of the unrest and also the diplomatic issues and how diplomacy is faced. If you like, I can talk specifically about Bahrain when you have the issues between the Shiite and Sunnis and how that's being played out.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that the standoff between the Sunnis and the Shia has always been in existence. I'm not sure to what extent it's been exacerbated in recent times. I mean, it seems like at one point, or I can't remember a time when they weren't at each other's throats and killing each other. I mean, how do they see this ever resolving, or do they?
So So when you speak with people, you know, in the region, you wouldn't get such a dramatic picture as the one that you just painted. A lot of people will say that that Sunnis and Shiites lived harmoniously for decades, even prior to that, that the regional conflicts that are being exacerbated by the sectarian mm-hmm. issue are relatively new. So when I spoke with one of the senior government officials within the lower house of parliament in Bahrain, mm-hmm. Fortunately, during the meeting, we were able to join to the conversation the cultural advisor for the parliament. He was a former leader of the Shiite, I would call it rebellion or opposition movement, and now mm-hmm. was working with the government to find solutions for the unrest. And there was a very interesting conversation where he spoke about how communities, Shiite, Sunni, lived together. There was never issues regarding, the challenges that they currently face, and how these were being played out. And how this gets back to diplomacy, one of his roles was to come up with or identify solutions for the current situation.
Yeah, I think in some of these instances, though, I mean, I think about Bahrain, which is essentially, a Sunni dictatorship. And then you have Qatar, which is a monarchy run by it's a monarchy that's an absolute monarchy. And you have other countries like Morocco, which is, again, a monarchy. None of these countries have the same kind of sectarian conflict, or visibly so, that you see in other countries, like right now, for example, Libya, Syria. However, it never really existed there either until there's a power vacuum and the dictators or strongmen were deposed. So I think maybe, I'm not sure to what extent the examples like Bahrain, Qatar would provide a solution to inform, the situation in some of these other jurisdictions, when ultimately the solution seems to be just put another strong man in place who can keep all the different sects under control and protect everyone's rights. Is that their view as well, or how do they see leadership in terms of how, leadership manages to affect these kinds of things?
So I'm glad you brought that up, and why I say I'm glad that you brought that up is because we tend to frame problems from our own worldviews. So mm-hmm. the information that we gather and we interpret through our own personal beliefs and understandings mm-hmm. and our experiences form our opinions and beliefs.
Right.
So one of the things that I always try to do is be objective in my analysis of a situation or an environment, and I can't go in with any preconceived notions or ideas. Mm-hmm. So when mm-hmm. I listen to these individuals and I listen to, their thoughts and their beliefs and their ideas and opinion, it's very enlightening. Mm-hmm. So let me give you an example.
Sure.
When I was speaking with a lot of the folks in Bahrain, mm-hmm. I asked, and I was privileged to some insights on how they addressed the problem after the Pearl Revolution. And they immediately looked outside. They took outside sources, and I believe they even commissioned a legal firm in Chicago to do an analysis. Mm-hmm. And they paid a considerable amount of money for the analysis, and they delivered a 75-80-page report that basically reaffirmed what the government was saying. Hey, you need to do this. It was the fault of these people. And
right.
and really, when I spoke with the people within the ministries, and when I spoke with people in the military, it was a totally different perspective and a totally different view. So let me weave this back to diplomacy. You can't outsource diplomacy. You can't bring in Westerners or Senator Kerry, who's very idealistic, and come up and say, here's a solution. The solutions that will work or can be effective are found within the societies of where the conflict exists. So mm-hmm. at the end of the day, here's a great example. we have Senator Kerry, we have the Russian delegates, we have Syrian delegates, we have delegates from Saudi Arabia, and they
right.
agree to a ceasefire in Yemen. I mean, excuse
mm-hmm.
me, in Syria.
Syria. Mm-hmm.
Which we all know will never work. And the reason why is it's so dislocated or disjointed between mm-hmm. who the diplomats are and who the people on the ground are. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're never going to have those warring, you know, different factions stop fighting because Senator Kerry came up with a good idea and he agreed with his counterpart in Russia and the Saudis who have a vested interest in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes back to the Bahrain example where when I was talking to these individuals within the government and they said, we are acutely aware of the problems that we face or the challenges
mm-hmm.
that we face.
Mm-hmm.
We can find the solutions and it should be upon us to find these solutions. And to outsource solutions or diplomacy is really a failed endeavor. And we see it being played out historically.
Mm-hmm.
When we look at the last, I mean, can you tell me, Rachel, when the last effective peace deal was negotiated, implemented, and actually...
No.
And I argue that, it's actually World War II. Some would argue that it would be Bosnia-Herzegovina, but that we've seen, you know, kind of been dismantled along sectarian fault lines and economic lines. So why is diplomacy failing? And what I have, you know, my hypothesis is that, especially now, that if you cannot, we go back to Machiavelli, you know, when we talk about the military is the last, bastion of diplomacy. And
right.
we don't have a military arm to back our diplomatic efforts. You can't come to the peace table with no leverage and expect to have a diplomatic solution.
So given everything you're saying there, does Vladimir Putin have a point when he says that you're not going to find peace in Syria without involving Bashar al-Assad? The elected government
yes.
of Syria.
He represents one of the warring factions within Syria. I believe that, you know, and I don't
mean
to laugh.
He represents the head of government, right?
Exactly. And he has a seat at the table when it comes to brokering an agreement or a peace deal. And it's funny how, you know, we as Westerners, we as the United Nations, we as, you know, the self-righteous individuals who can say what is right and wrong.
Yeah.
And it really befuddles me because who is the United States to put a name on a terrorist? You know, we're gonna say the Houthis are a terrorist organization, and we're gonna put them on a list, and now we're not gonna let them come to the table and negotiate because they're a terrorist organization.
Right. But what's really interesting
about
what you're saying there is something that I've actually thought about this a lot, and it's the fact that there was another group of Iran-affiliated, not the Houthis, but another similar group, and they had set up a base in their exiles, and they had set up a base in near Paris in France here. And at one point, they were on the State Department's list of terror groups. And then what happened is Rudy Giuliani, John Bolton, and some other people from, you know, the government and well-known figures, they retired and then they came over here, Paris, to give a talk to this group, and the media covered it. And I don't know if they were aware that the media would cover it, but they were paid to come out and give a speech. Fran Townsend was another one. And ultimately, when it got out into the media that these individuals had come up, prominent individuals who had all spoken out against terrorism, had actually spoken to a group on the terror watch list, suddenly, oh, they're not on the terror watch list anymore. Like, they're off the list, and they were never, you know, it's like it was just a random designation that, well, they're okay now. It seems to depend on whether or not they're useful at any particular time to leverage against somebody who's even worse or who's considered to be even worse at any given time.
Yeah, I mean, understanding, having a really in-depth understanding of the issues within Yemen, and then having, you know, somebody within State Department to say, oh, we need to put them on a terrorist watch list, or we need to exclude them from any potential negotiations or you know, things of that nature. It's kind of absurd when the Houthis are an integral part of the culture and the country. So I don't understand or have the information to understand why or the process on how a group or individuals are incorporated into the watch list
I mean, this was the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Khalq, and designated as a terror group dedicated to overthrowing the Iranian regime. And they're essentially communists at the core, and they exiled to France, and these individuals actually came here to France and were paid, I guess, through a speaking agency to actually speak to them and an event involving them. And then suddenly, next thing you know, they are off the list, and you even have retired generals lobbying on their behalf to get them off the list. It was unbelievable, and I know that as a person with a media platform, I was even approached about this group, and what do I think about maybe writing about how they're being persecuted? It's like, wait a second, they're on the terror list, and the whole idea was to get them off the list. And why? I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting question, because on one hand you have this deal that was in the works, the Iran nuclear deal, to lift the sanctions against Iran. On the other hand, you have these negotiations going on to get this exile group that opposes the regime in place in Iran to give them some support and cachet and authority and credibility. It was very bizarre what was going on. And it kind of goes back to everything what you were saying about the fact that there are some people who just make very interesting proclamations and designations as it suits them, it seems.
Yeah, what I believe needs to happen or occur is that there really needs to be a change in the way diplomacy is looked at, the way it's implemented, the way it's designed, really a paradigm shift. I don't know how we've moved away from, you know, effective diplomatic efforts and moved into an era where diplomacy is, you know, shuttle diplomacy in the 1970s and 80s with in the Middle East seem to be effective, if not just to keep tensions at a manageable or palatable level. But it appears that, you know, we can't even do that now with shuttle diplomacy. You know, I would love to see what Senator Kerry and his entourage, you know, what their bills are, their travel budget and their expenses are, and see if we can take that money and allocate it to some development programs that might have an enduring benefit, or to, you know, maybe gather understanding of the parties involved and come up with solutions that would provide tangible benefits to all. You know, one of the most disappointing things that I saw, and it really makes me question the thought process behind you know, what State Department does, is I believe it was after the Paris attacks when Senator Kerry he went to Paris with I forget who the singer is, but he sang the song "You've Got a Friend." And
oh yeah, nobody really remembers the name of that singer because he's kind of a has-been.
Yeah, but you know, I sat there and I said, "Who thought about this? Who did they have a bunch of like interns in a room, or did they have some real sharp diplomats? I mean, because I know that it wasn't Henry Kissinger who sat there and said, you know, we need to get him to go there and sing "You've Got a Friend" because that's really going to solve the problems and really, you know, smooth things over between us. So what I'm saying is the level of sophistication that is you know, displayed or that is coming up with our solutions, in my opinion, is, you know, not even at the graduate level in diplomacy. I think, you know, it was my opinion, it's a bunch of undergrads who are sitting around spitballing ideas And, you know, some senior folks are saying, hey, that sounds like a good idea. You know, maybe we can tweet that. Maybe we can, you know, put that on Facebook. You know, maybe I can post it. Whereas, you know, nobody has a long-term solution that says, well, how is that going to solve something 5 years from now? Or how is that going to, you know, solve this crisis 12 months from now? So we're looking for that, you know, that catch line or that, you know, that make it stick moment in the here and now. But there's that not that approach that's looking at enduring solutions that really involve the population and involve the all the parties that are affected, which I really you know, I'm not seeing these days.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely fascinating, and I agree with you on that. And it would be nice if there was a little more analysis, a little less belligerence when it comes to trying to resolve these things, because I just don't see an end to it otherwise. And it seems as though the situation isn't getting better. It's just exacerbating when we have Libya, the idea of going back to Libya and trying to redo that situation. Syria is a perpetual nightmare. Iraq, and it's just like enough is enough. And I think Dmitry Medvedev, the Prime Minister of Russia, actually made a really interesting point when he said, somebody evoked the idea the other day of Saudi Arabia and an Arab coalition going in for a land war in Syria now. And he said, you know, does the United States and Saudi Arabia, they really want a perpetual war in the Middle East? Is that really what people want? And I think he makes a really good point. And I think that's where mm-hmm. we're headed. I mean, there's no evidence over the past 10 years, 15 years now, suggest that it's anything other than that at this point.
Well, let me bring up 2 points rather quickly. The first mm-hmm. point is, you know, just returning from the Gulf, there is an air of tension and a mm-hmm. sense of unease that really permeates the entire region. So there's talk of civil unrest within the Assad dynasty, the kingdom. And they are really unhappy with the Minister of Defense, who's the second in line to take the throne. I forget his mm-hmm. name. But there's mm-hmm. talk about how there's this internal dissent within the royal family and how they're not happy with him. And they're looking at mm-hmm. making some moves. And the reason why is because he's acting very quickly, hastily, and is not really methodical in his decision-making, and it's put the kingdom into a bad position. Right now, they're looking for solutions. Saudi Arabia is looking for solutions mm-hmm. for the conflict in Yemen. They are basically running the U.S. counterinsurgency playbook. Mm-hmm. The UAE has solicited the assistance of expats from the U.K., from Australia, mm-hmm. from other countries. And they're running the coin FM3-24, and it's failing. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. this should come to no surprise. It failed in Iraq. It failed in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. And it'll fail in Yemen. So
that's
in a
strategy.
Quagmire.
They're using a perpetual losing strategy. And when you say the UAE and expats, are you talking about, you know, Eric Prince and his group of mercenaries and people like that who are helping the government?
Nope. No, I'm just talking. No, and listen, you know, I've known Eric, you know, and you know, I'm not going to speak badly. I think Eric. Yeah, no, he's in the UAE. He has a home over there. Mm-hmm. He sold it, but
right.
No, I'm talking about the folks say in the different companies in the military industrial complex mm-hmm. that are
right.
over there selling their wares and trying to make. Mm-hmm. capitalize and make a lot of mm-hmm. money on a mm-hmm. war, which, you know, they're a business.
Sure.
I can get that. But
sure.
when you're a company like mine and you can offer mm-hmm. an enduring solution to peace,
right.
and it's at a fraction of the cost of war,
yeah.
you know, it's a different solution. So, which leads to
that's
my
a tough sell.
Second
you know, that's
point.
A tough sell, Jim.
It is.
You know, when
it
it's
is,
a fraction of the
you.
Cost, how do you justify a budget with a fraction of the cost?
Yeah, so this will lead to my second point, which is what is being experienced today in the Middle East and in other parts of the world is a phenomenon known as identity conflict theory. Mm-hmm. It's being played out, identity conflict. So what happens in identity conflict theory and is this kind of like identity politics, if you're familiar with that, is that anytime you threaten somebody's identity, you will immediately get a visceral, powerful response in return. So I would say that companies are, let's just take Yemen, for example. When Saudi Arabia and the UAE or a coalition of Arab or Gulf states enter Yemen, they are automatically, or, you know, they invade, they are automatically triggering identity conflict theory or identity conflict, where they, their mere presence alone is triggering or inciting behaviors that are resistance to or resistant to the identities of the indigenous people within Yemen. So
it's like when you catch
care.
A kid with this, it's like when you catch a little kid with his hand in the cookie jar and you say, I caught you with your hand in the cookie jar. And you say, no, you didn't. No, you didn't, because you're suddenly attacking that kid's whole world, right? It's kind of like that,
yes,
right?
Exactly. So what you're,
and they're
going to
resist even
is,
if they're wrong.
Yeah, and what happens is you build on a cycle of insecurity. And then you get locked into a cycle of insecurity because, so my first, my just my presence creates this identity conflict. Now I'm going to attack you. So my response is to, you know, is escalate. So what you'll see is an escalation of these events or activities, which causes a perpetual cycle that reinforces itself, and you can't get out of it. You can't break it. So now let's weave back in the diplomatic or the you know, diplomacy narrative that we started the conversation with. So how do you inject diplomacy into this cycle of insecurity that is perpetually building upon itself and creating more momentum and mass and snowballing, and then you're trying from the outside, from the periphery, to break it with diplomatic efforts that have no teeth? So there is, you know, therein lies the problem. You've created a cycle of insecurity based upon military activities, and now you try to interject diplomacy that has no teeth behind it, and there's where it will never succeed.
Yeah. Right, and it's going to be railroad. So basically what you're saying is diplomacy has to be injected a lot earlier in that pathway.
Exactly. So where you see, or there's two extremes. It's diplomacy is in, you know, injected in the initial phases to stop the perpetuation of bad behavior, or you have some catastrophic event, or you have some military activities that allow you to have some teeth. So one of the things that we've learned through conflict resolution is for diplomatic efforts to be effective, you need to have certain things to make sure that diplomacy will work. So one of those is that you have to have the military capability or capacity to ensure that both or all warring factions or, you know, or stakeholders will feel secure when fighting stops, that they won't be taken advantage of. So you're going to have a military presence there. You're also going to have to be able to enforce some of the diplomatic you know, things that are negotiated and put on the table. That is going to take a military force. So when the U.S. abdicates its responsibility, then you're left with a void on who is going to oversee the diplomatic effort, you know, everything that was put in place from the diplomatic efforts. So now you have, are you going to rely on the U.N. and U.N. peacekeeping forces, you know, which we've seen in the past, they are very ineffective in African continents. So you see where if I'm a Houthi, and you're asking me to put down my weapons, why am I going to put down my weapons when either the Saudi Arabian-led coalition is going to kill me, AQAP is going to kill me, or, you know, is it a Christian-Muslim thing, or is it also a tribal thing, you know, where you have different warrings and militias who are just going to, I'm going to put down my weapon? Why? Because the militia right across the street is going to kill me.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And then
you get blamed for then everybody says that they're the belligerents and the aggressors, and they're just really caught in a situation where they don't really have much of a logical choice if they want to survive, right?
It's self-preservation being played out.
But yet
we have, you know, we have idealists who work in the State Department who have never been on the ground in a combat zone, and they're talking, you know, ideology You know, why can't we just have peace? And I really wish I knew that singer's name. Why can't we just bring him over to Yemen and we can have a we can have a concert and he can sing You've Got a Friend? I think that would work.
Yeah, that didn't even work here in Paris. It really didn't.
Yeah.
It made an impression, but probably not the one they were hoping for. Because we hear about all these wonderful, there are better concerts at the Stade de France than took place at the Élysée. He could have picked any one of the celebrities who appeared on the stage last night at the Grammys, right? And he chose some guy's name I don't even recall.
For me, I watched these events being played out, and quite honestly, I'm frustrated, but I understand, and not that I have empathy, but I understand how they can, how people can come to these conclusions, because they don't understand identity conflict theory, or they don't understand social science theories, or they haven't had practical experience in military operations or seen a combat environment. After three tours in Afghanistan, deployments to Iraq, it really gave me some very unique insights into population societies, how they're affected and their influence. And one thing that I want to introduce very quickly is the fact that communications, unprecedented access to communications technology has really accelerated a lot of what you're experiencing today, because now people who have never been exposed to ideas or beliefs outside of their tribe or their region or local area are now having access to communications and information, and now they're starting to question things and demand things, which puts more stresses on governments and private sector companies. So this really also facilitates or accelerates, society's play in conflict. And, it really breaks my heart to see what's going on in Syria for 5 years when, 3.5 years ago we introduced a solution to the director of DIA, and he said, this is awesome. This is the best analysis I've seen. And I asked him a question, does this analysis reside within the intelligence community? And he said, no, it doesn't.
Why?
And then he followed, because the level of analysis that we were able to produce was from the information that we could collect on the ground. And believe it or not, the intelligence community, with all of its resources, is a dinosaur, because collection activities are focused on Cold War era SIGINT. Human capability has gone to shit, to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah, of course.
And you can't validate your hypothesis without ground truth. And we were able to go to areas that were occupied by Free Syrian Army units. We're able to talk to NGOs. We're able to obtain atmospherics on the ground, information on Free Syrian Army units, their leaders, whether they subordinated themselves to the civil administrative councils that were the nascent government bodies in areas that were still controlled by the rebels, and deliver an analysis that the director of DIA said every brigade commander should have this analysis. And when I said, are you gonna commission us or are you gonna contract us to perform these? He said no. Because this is a political issue, and this was before the red lines happened. But to my point, going back to diplomacy, there was a small window of opportunity where having this information would have advantaged any diplomatic efforts to understand what was actually occurring on the ground in Syria, what the and what potential outcomes were. And that level of understanding, I don't think, is resonant within the Department of State and other organizations where they send officials out who have subject matter experts, in a certain area, but yet have no real understanding. So that's why I think we're really hamstrung diplomatically.
Yeah, and it's obvious because the end result has been all too obvious, unfortunately. James Sisco, founder and president of Enodo Global. It's been great having you on the show. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure, Rachel, and thanks for having me. Okay. And look forward to speaking with you again in the future.
You bet. Right,
bye-bye.
Good night. All right, that's it for today's show. We'll be back again next week, same time, 7 p.m. Eastern. Have a good week in the meantime. I'm Rachel Marsden. Remember, intelligence is a weapon, so be sure to use it. Good night.